Business people seem to think that if they cut a deal and throw their friends and allies under a bus, that somehow the legislature will abandon the idea of a sales tax increase. Oh, who needs that extra money? They are fooling themselves, and they are losing friends and allies in the process. All right, well, for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. A big thank you to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. And you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Theme music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare and are used with permission of the artist. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Find links at the website kbo.fm/freeculture. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Here at KBOO, on February 20th, we'll be celebrating National Love Your Pet Day. If you ever experienced the loss of an animal friend, you are welcome to share with us how you felt and how it changed you to lose that beloved friend and ally. An unfortunate downside to the blessing of the friendship our animal friends provide is the almost inevitable goodbye that comes when our dear friends' lifespans are far shorter than our own. You can send your audio to publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day, or you can also call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voice mailbox 302 and go ahead and record your story. Email publicaffairs@kboo.org with any questions.
KBOO. Science, accumulated and reviewed over decades, tells us that our planet is changing in ways that will have profound impacts on all of humankind.
My name is Mike Crenshaw, and this is Earthbound. 8 billion is a lot of us. Critical mass of consciousness, some wanna ask if God exists, and I can't really say that I'm positive, but I am confident that apocalypse is a consequence of thoughtlessness. Without clean water and oxygen, then the populace will not persist. The sky, the land, Mother Nature is all we have, and it all is sacred. The time is now, don't wait to waste it. Once it's gone, then we can't replace it. What if this world is all we get? All the signs say stop, but I'm not convinced. What is the hypothesis if we continue the opposite? I'm like a mechanic on a diagnostic, eyes open, trying to see the options, increase the peace, proceed with caution, take risk, shapeshift, decrease the toxins. We're on a mission to do less damage, limit emissions, and eat organic. I refuse to panic, but while I'm on the planet, I'm gonna make a difference before we vanish. Skin, scales, fins, and feathers, fire and ice, change in weather. We're all in this together. Here we are now, Earthbound. What if I told you the earth was perfect, respected, protected, and you don't deserve it? Look for direction and search for purpose and figure out how to make it worth it. Go hard for the youth who will receive it and think about the future that will leave them. I can't escape, I can't fly to space, and I can't even sleep, so I'm wide awake. Reflect on the choices and why I make them, mostly self-preservation. The meat we eat destroys the land and how they slaughter the beasts is torture, man. And if I still eat that, despite the fact I think about the personal side effects, I'm rolling through the hood and I'm stuck in traffic, thinking about our destructive habits. Kids on the corner just dropping wrappers. You can blame them, but where's the factory plastic raft the size of Alaska floating in the ocean? Massive disaster. Tragic. Gotta do something drastic. Can't wait for the government of magic. Human race, we can adapt, but where's the change? Is there a plan for that? Skin, scales, fins and feathers, fire and ice, change and weather. We're all in this together. Here we are now, earthbound. Aquarius through Capricorn, I'm a trouble on my path and I'm off and gone. Marathon, decathlon, North America, the capital of Babylon. I'm gonna back at home and get practical. Think, how could it be more tactical? I gotta strategize, harmonize, and be compatible with what's natural. Can we turn it around and wanna burn it down? Kid an old girl for a herd of cows. Heard about that in 82, learning about what acid rain could do. And it's not sustainable, it's not debatable. The same capacity is not available. Self-annihilation is not explainable. That's a violation. What I came to do, shed light, spread life. I prepare to fight, but will more bloodshed ever make it right? They're dropping bombs and we can talk it out. Take a look around, see what I'm talking about. Conservation is a conversation, but not at the expense of the population. No justice or equality with destruction of the ecology. I can't put my trust in policy when most of the economy is based on waste and exploitation. So the changes with the choice I'm making. Harmony between human beings, respect for nature and all living things. Drinking water straight from the stream. Imagine something so pristine. Skin, scales, fins and feather, fire and ice, changing weather. We're all in this together. Here we are now, earthbound.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. Good afternoon around the world, on the internet at kboo.fm, or right here at home in Portland, Oregon on KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio. I am Mike Crenshaw, your host of Culture in Motion, twice monthly show where we talk about the intersection between art, culture, music, activism, and politics. And I've got a very exciting subject today that's near and dear to my heart, and two very exciting guests. Today, I want to talk about this Black Indigenous People of Color Task Force, Advocates for Action, in association with and sponsored by Love is King and the Alaskan Wilderness League. There's a group of folks who have spent time in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, who are all Black, Indigenous, and people of color, led by Chad Brown and Love is King. And they're gonna be headed to Washington, D.C., to lobby Congress to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So we're gonna get into it, and I'm gonna invite my first guest on. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one of the finest examples of wilderness remaining anywhere in the world. Places like Yellowstone, Yosemite, and the Grand Canyon define for many what it means to be an American. The Arctic Refuge is one of these places. To that end, members of Congress must join Indigenous leaders and a majority of Americans who support protecting this national treasure. Alaska Wilderness League, in alliance with Love is King, is proud to announce the historic launching of the Alaska Wilderness League Activation Council. This marks a unique partnership between a BIPOC organization and a traditional conservation group to unite and cultivate BIPOC leaders to activate their leadership and build advocacy around protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We are combining our human capital to defend the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from destructive oil and gas development, said Chad Brown, founder of Love is King. We're learning from and following the leadership of the Gwich'in, who have lived in this place since time began. Alaska is home to Native tribes who have for millennia relied on Alaska's lands and waters for their way of life. Alaska is home to an irreplaceable diversity of peoples, wildlife, and ecosystems. This partnership is uniquely positioned to engage, enlighten, and activate Congress to take action to restore long-standing bipartisan protections that have protected the Arctic Refuge from oil and gas development for decades. The council will help establish dialogue channels and launch conversations with decision makers that have not traditionally been part of the efforts to protect the Arctic Refuge. Our purpose is to continue to protect and strengthen our current environmental laws, preventing legislative attempts to undermine our environmental progress. Hit the hill. This partnership focuses on bringing Love is King, Operation Rome leaders, all of whom have had the opportunity to spend time in the Arctic Refuge, to Washington, D.C., where they can share their story and experience with decision makers on Capitol Hill. They'll have meetings with the U.S. House and Senate lawmakers and other key committees and groups critical to protecting the Arctic. The team will be joined by senior staff from Alaska Wilderness League, who will help navigate the hill and cover nuanced questions that might come up. all to ensure that the participants' stories have maximum impact. The lawmakers with whom we will meet are poised to take greater actions to advance protections for the Arctic. Activity will include learning about the history and talking about the history of the Arctic Refuge, legislative synopsis, lobbyist training, identifying decision makers, people from Portland, Oregon, such as Solomon Ebay, Matt McLean's, Chia Togo, Jocelyn Rice will be there. And my first very special guest I have today with me, Courtney Langtot. Courtney, did I pronounce your last name right?
You did not. No, so it's French. And so the last T is actually silent. And the C is like a G, like a silent G. So it's Langtot.
Langtot. Okay. Now I know. How are you doing today, Courtney?
I'm so good. I'm currently in Alaska. So I grew up in Alaska. I'm currently in Anchorage. And the sun is just now trying to come out. It's like just after 9. So wintertime in Alaska is rough. But if you remember when we were there, that sun never set, which is like the extreme opposites that make it just the best place ever.
Yeah, I have yet to visit Alaska in the winter. But so tell us about that. You said it's 9 o'clock. The sun is coming up. How much daylight are you going to have today?
It progresses quickly. So at the height of it, so, you know, winter solstice, I think it's like 5.5 hours of daylight. It's crazy. But now I think we're already at almost 8 hours.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, it goes from one extreme to the other. You know, in the summertime, you get technically it's, you know, even at when the sun sets, it's still dusk. It's still daylight. It never gets fully dark. So, you know, it takes all that time, that progressive time to go from that extreme of 5.5 hours to sun setting at 2 a.m. and rising at 4 a.m., you know.
Right. And what temperature is it up there Fahrenheit right now?
Ooh, I think it's right around 20 degrees. It's winter. So here's the thing. Anyone debating on coming to Alaska, period. Most people think summertime is the best time, which it's a great time, but it's a 3-month window and everyone and their mama is in town. So tourism is crazy. Everything is packed. Renting a car, renting anything is just extremely expensive. So I highly recommend shoulder seasons, which is spring and fall. May and September are the best times because you get like a little bit of the almost summer or just out of summer. So you get the temperature. But watching spring into summer or summer into fall is just really beautiful.
Wow. So I met you in Alaska for the first time a couple years ago when we both participated in a Love is King Operation Rome trip to the Arctic Refuge. Are you born and raised in Alaska? Because at the time I thought you lived in Denver, right?
I did. So wasn't born here. My mom was military. So we moved here when I was 5 and then she got the military. And so we stayed. And then I went to a boarding school in Mississippi to finish high school, came back for a year and then left for good. So when I met you, that was the first time. So that was 2021. It was July 2021. That was the first time I had been back in a decade. Growing up here, I did not love the outdoors. I loathed it, actually. And so when I met you, I was already in love with the outdoors. And then life happened. We came back from our Arctic trip. I stayed in town. I stayed in Anchorage for 2 weeks and then I left. And then 2 weeks later, my dad passed. Mm-hmm. So I've just been back and forth to and from Alaska for the last 2 years, just kind of taking care of things.
Big condolences on that major loss.
Thank you.
That's a lot. And you, when I met you, you had been doing something called the Unpopular Black. Will you explain to our listeners what that is?
Yeah. So the Unpopular Black, it's an encouragement for Black people to adventure the American outdoors. And so I provide representation, information, and access for how to get into the outdoors. So for the most part, the main barriers to the narrative that Black people don't, quote unquote, do outdoor things is based around historical factors of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And the outdoors and the outdoor industry being majority white facing and white focused. So for me, it's a matter of how do I provide the representation to show that Black people have been doing outdoor activities, historically have been doing them, and then those who are doing them now, as well as how do we even access the outdoors? If you've never been on a hike and you don't know anyone who's been on a hike, like, you just might not have that connection to even know how to prepare for it. Like, it can seem like a grand idea. So I just help to bridge the gaps in that barrier.
So you are an expert outdoors person. Would you say that about yourself?
Yeah. So definitely more of a general outdoors. My expertise definitely is in camping and hiking and a little bit of overlanding and some water sports as well.
And if people want to, because I followed some of your adventures on Instagram, if people want to find you on Instagram, how do they find, or online, how do they find your work?
So on Instagram is at TheUnpopularBlack. And then theunpopularblack.com is my website. You can email me through there or email me holler, H-O-L-L-E-R at TheUnpopularBlack.
You're out in the wilderness, places that are so remote, sometimes you're not seeing other human beings, correct?
I mostly adventure solo. For me, as a Black woman, that's how I feel safest, when I don't see anyone. Because for the most part, the outdoors is not necessarily only white facing and white focused, but also white male. So for me, I just feel safest to be in places that I don't see anyone, and therefore I assume no one can see me.
So you're confronting and dissolving a lot of barriers that exist in the minds of people. One being Black folks don't go outside. Two being women. Three, Black women being outdoors by themselves. So I'm sure you answer a lot of questions about fear, because a lot of people have fear in our imaginations about the terrible things that can happen to us. Can you tell us about how you navigated and overcome fear in your own, or what, maybe there was an absence of fear from the beginning for you? How do you talk about that, or how do you experience that?
You know, I believe that for me, there's a level of confidence that I have within my own self and my own abilities. So I've only been an outdoor enthusiast since 2016. Up until then, I was like, we don't do that. I'm good. I'm not trying to get dirty. That's gross. And then I was going through a breakup, and one of my very best guy friends, who to me, I relate to. So representation is important, but also relatability. He's a really good friend, and he was like, we're going camping, and he had done it regularly and always invited me, and I was always like, nah. But he was like, me and my family are going camping, please come. And in order to distract myself from the breakup, I was like, fine. At the time, I was living in Denver, and we went to the San Juan Mountains, and I just was blown away. And so previous to outdoor adventuring, I had always been a city adventurer. You know, let's say I'm going to a coffee shop, I would look for a coffee shop in a neighborhood that I've never been to. I would find ways to explore different parts of the city that I had never been to, or like when I would travel, same thing. And so through that, I understood how to get back to where I was going if ever I was lost, or how to pay attention to things in order to make sure I have safety points. You know, let's say my phone dies. Okay, well, I remember this landmark, so I know I passed this, and I remember taking a left over there. So first things first, I think it's really important to understand how to have confidence in your own abilities in order to adventure, right? And so adventure isn't necessarily only outdoors. Life is an adventure. And so even if it's just going to a different target or taking the scenic route home, paying attention to different things, helping yourself stimulate your mind in other ways, I think is really important, especially for women. Women, when I'm with my like other woman friends, it's interesting noticing even the ones who also adventure, how much they rely on their GPS, how much or how easy they get lost, because, you know, they oftentimes they're used to their husband or their boyfriend driving or whatever, right? So for me, my biggest recommendation is take more control in your life and try to comfortably get lost as much and as often as you can, because then you'll also gain confidence in yourself of like how to get unlost, how to figure the route out, but it also helps you to figure levels of yourself out. you know.
So that when I hear you say that, I think of, yeah, you are an adventurer. You're somebody who takes joy in the unknown aspects, the uncertainty of your environment. That's awesome. I have a lot of fun there too. What are you said a term that I would like for you to define for the listeners who don't know. Overlanding. What is overlanding?
Overlanding is essentially going on dirt roads. It's generally driving. If you have a motorbike, I think that's also considered overlanding. And it's usually results in camping. Generally, I think it results in like some version of like dispersed camping. And so dispersed camping is a non-formal camping. So there's like the formal campgrounds where you like hook up your RV or even if it, you know, is just marked by the state. Dispersed camping, overlanding, it's usually, well, there's a dirt road down here. Let me see where it goes. Oh, and look, there's a place to pull off that has a great view or, you know, has a clearing that I can set up my tent. Because I'm a solo Black woman, I feel safest car camping because I can lock my doors.
So tell us some questions arise, and then I want to get back to the DC trip coming up to lobby Congress before we break. But two questions come up for me. One is, what is one of the most challenging or harrowing situations you found yourself in terms of risk or being lost?
So I don't love to hike. Hiking is not my favorite. I'm a destination hiker. If there's a reason why I'm going, then great. I had a job in Idaho, in Southern Idaho. I'm really into hot springs, right? And there's a point where I was like super into hot springs. Idaho has some of the most natural hot springs in a state. And so I was going to Idaho a lot. I was hiking to a hot spring. It was an 8-mile hike, and I think it was round trip, eight miles. I did not know. This is like beginning of May. I just was wildly unprepared. It was super hot. Long story short, I got lost. And granted, like, it was one trail in, one trail out. But because I was so unprepared, I think I ran out of water. Mm. It just was like all like the epitome of, what are you doing? This is elementary basic preparation. And I was so hot. I was extremely tired also. It just was a lot. And so again, like, I knew I was gonna make it back to the car, but I think even for a second I was like, am I gonna make it? It just was so much. It was so much. And then there was a point, another instance, I was overlanding in Utah, and I was trying to get to this spot that is beautiful. I've seen it all over Instagram. I'm like, okay, I have to make it there. And generally my goal is to always get to the places before sunrise. I'm on my way, and I think I'm like within a mile or no, I'm within like 3 miles. All of a sudden it turns to sand. Like the trail turns to mostly sand. And I'm like, holy, am I going to, one, risk it? Am I going to make it if I risk it?
Oh, and you meant sunset. You're trying to get there before sunset, right?
No, by sunrise.
By sunrise.
By sunrise. So like for me, getting to a place by sunrise is how I can almost make it to where, fingers crossed, is only me that's there. Generally, most people usually start their adventures by sunrise, right? So they get to wherever they're going, usually around, depending on how far it is from town. Because most people get to an adventure by 9 or 10 a.m. So for me, getting there by sunrise, you know, generally if it's, you know, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, then I have a few hours of the place to myself. Yeah, but so anyway, so I almost get stuck in the sand. I don't have cell service. I'm in the middle of nowhere, Utah, like down by Zion. So if anyone's familiar with how few and far between the towns are in Zion or near Zion. So I didn't make it because there was a point where I turned around. I was like, I don't have enough confidence in myself in driving in sand. I don't have enough confidence in this car or the gear that I had. I didn't have any rescue gear. So if I was stuck, I would have to walk to find help. So luckily I found a patch where it wasn't too deep of sand and I turned around, but then I had to go back and almost got stuck going back on the sand that I just traversed. So, you know, it's one of those that, like, being confident in yourself, but also knowing when you can't.
Wow. That makes me wonder, do you carry a firearm with you for safety?
I hadn't because I have one now, but I hadn't because more so I feel like it just escalates the situation. I have confidence also in my ability to de-escalate. Granted, it is because of how I look and how I'm perceived. Unfortunately, I go with many privileged stereotypes. I'm petite, I'm light-skinned, I'm quote-unquote cute, like I can play the super innocent role. So I have a lot of things to my advantage that I can play certain roles to get out of situations. But this last year, I've been exploring more of the American South, and I plan to move to the South to explore and do more work there. And so now I feel like it's important to have a gun just in case.
I heard that. Let me ask you, what are your, I'm not going to ask you top five. Can you give me and the listeners your top three or three of your favorite places to explore and that you return to?
Yeah, it's always such a hard question for me because the places that I've been to are very, they very much resemble the place in my life that I was at when I visited them, you know? And so honestly, my favorite places, the generalized areas of Utah. I try to go to Utah as often as possible. And depending on where I'm coming from, Moab is 4 hours from Denver. So it's easy to just drive over to Moab. Depending on if I'm flying in, I'll probably fly into Vegas and come up to St. George, Utah, which actually, sorry, I'm doing a whole like long explanation. Anyways, Utah, I love Utah. The desert is a very, very spiritual place for me. In its vastness, like I feel like I can do and be anything. So I highly recommend Utah for its desert. Idaho, I know Idaho is something that is either not on people's radar, or for Black folks, it's on their radar out of fear because of its ties to the KKK. To that, I've been to Utah 5 or 6 times now, and like backwoods Utah, and I've never had a negative experience. There is a town that I go through that I never stop in, but it's a small town. But I also have to go through it to get to the hot springs that I'm going to. But I've stopped in a lot of other towns along the way, mm-hmm. and you know, for gas or food or whatever, and like I never had an issue. So Idaho, within about 4 to 5 hours from Boise, where there's a lot of hot springs in those areas that I love Idaho. You can drive 4 to 5 hours from any place and be in a completely different landscape and terrain. It's mind blowing. Like you can go from these mountains and hills that look like they're in Jurassic Park to high desert plains to Rocky Mountains. It's mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And then I really love Northern California.
Thank you for that. And I'm going to encourage you to come to Oregon. Make sure you let us know before you come so that we can show you around, you know?
Mm-hmm. I've been to Oregon. Oregon scares me.
Okay, so that's interesting because I find Oregon to be a very beautiful place, similar to what you said about Idaho. Many different natural environments, but I need to pay attention to how scary my own neck of the woods is.
Portland was scary to me.
Are you out here?
So I was there in 2019, and then I was just there this past June.
Mm-hmm.
There's just the energy of Portland that, to me, that feels really chaotic. And then when I found out the history of like the state of Oregon and its anti anything but whiteness.
Yeah.
It's just such a bad vibe for me. But I went down to the really popular hot springs. That's like 3 or 4 hours from Portland. It's in like the Tokati. It's down in Umpqua National Forest.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been there. Beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, tell us in closing, you're going to DC to lobby Congress. Is this something that you've done before?
No, I'm really excited to just observe and witness how, like, what the political side of the outdoors is.
Okay. And you believe you do you have a passionate orientation towards saving the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
You know, I think that it's wild to even contemplate that. But as someone who grew up in Alaska, I understand how much the priority of oil and money over land resources and the indigenous people is. Like, as an adult looking back to all the things that, you know, we're indoctrinated in growing up here as, you know, Alaska is a new state, a newer state, you know, and I think it's like 50, 60 years old. And the things that we are taught in school and just in social conversation of, it's very colonizing. It is you know, the oil companies, the state of Alaska, the government, it's a very colonizer mindset. And so I'm thrilled to lobby on behalf of saving, protecting the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Like, it just makes no sense that this is even a conversation.
The last question I want to ask you, you know, because we both had our opportunity to experience this with a group of BIPOC folks a few years ago. What is it from your experience of actually being physically on the refuge, in the land, what is it about being there that you want people to understand that makes that land so important?
It's like as if you get to witness what Earth was like before humans messed it up.
Yeah, that's what's up.
It's like the pureness of it.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Just thinking about it, it kind of gives me pause because it's a very powerful feeling. Thank you, Courtney, for spending time with us here on Culture in Motion. It's really nice to reconnect and hear from you.
Yeah, this is really good. I'm so glad. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Be safe, and I hope to hear good news from DC.
Absolutely.
Yeah, big props for what you guys are about to do. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye. You're tuned in to Culture in Motion. I mean, we've been talking about Love is King, Operation Rome, which was a group of Black indigenous people of color who went to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Two different trips organized by Love is King, led by Chad Brown. I was part of the first cohort in 2021. Solomon Ebay is our next guest. Solomon, what's good?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. It's good to see you.
Yeah.
You went to you went on Operation Rome to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. What year was it?
It was also in 2021, but it was later on in that summer, the end of August.
So what was that experience like for you? Was that the first time you'd been to the Arctic Refuge?
Yeah, it was my first time in Alaska. First time seeing Arctic Refuge. It was really just like amazing, kind of mind blowing, getting a look at the amount of nature present in the area. Mm. And really just kind of like, you see a lot of the same stuff, but it's different. You know, there's mountains and there's grass and there's a little snow up there, but it's a different kind of mountain and it's some different grass and it's some different kind of snow. Yeah, it was just a really kind of eye-opening experience just to kind of see the diversity that exists out there. mm-hmm. in the wild.
I found the hike from the, when we went to our first campsite, the hike from the vehicles through the bush across the tundra was one of the hardest things I'd ever done physically, because of how much, how heavy our packs were and how deep our feet would sink into mm-hmm. the tundra with each step. Is that something you experienced as well?
Yeah, definitely. That was a very eye-opening experience. It was just kind of a reality check to just the arduous nature of just traversing the tundra. There was no like stable footing, and as you went along, so you're constantly trying to keep your balance. And like you said, you've got this big pack on, and yeah, every step you take is not sure. It doesn't feel sure. So it's like sapping like three times the energy that just taking a regular step would.
Yeah, that was something else. I enjoyed the pictures. It looked a little bit cloudier in your experience. We were up there in July and it was sunny most of the time. Did you experience rain and snow, or was it warm? What was the weather like for you?
We didn't get snowed on, but we got a little drizzle. We didn't have to endure any like real rainstorm, but there was some drizzle. It was a little bit cooler temperatures, I'm sure. A lot of morning like dew, like just thick wet air in the morning. Luckily, it seemed to be just windy enough the whole time to kind of keep the mosquitoes at bay.
Oh wow.
And I was definitely came into that knowledge, like as soon as the wind kind of went away, like as soon as the wind went away, mosquitoes just popped up everywhere, and you want a good 5-10 mile per hour wind at all times.
Yeah, I you know, luckily we had plenty of DEET, which smells terrible.
Right.
You know, I'd used DEET before in northern Minnesota in the Boundary Waters canoe area, but I grew to really another level of intolerance in terms of the smell of DEET. But without the DEET, the mosquitoes were treacherous, you know. The a lot of people would ask about the wildlife. You know, we saw a lot of wildlife, but I did not see a bear when I was there. Did you guys encounter any wildlife or see bears?
Didn't notice any bears. Was definitely on the lookout for that kind of thing. We did see muskox on a couple of occasions, you know, from a distance. Seen caribou a few times as well. A lot of really cool birds. Seeing this, I think it's called like a long-tailed jaeger. And it's like a giant hummingbird, because I had just seen it in the distance. It was just hovering, and I thought it was cool.
Wow.
Because there was a stream down the way near that second camp, near the Lake Galbraith, and there was like that stream that was coming down, and I seen this bird over there, and it was just hovering, kind of peeking back and forth this way. And the bird, in reality, is, I don't know, it's a large, it's not a huge bird, but it's a large bird, you know, at least as big as like a crow would be, you know. But it was just hovering just like how a hummingbird would do. I never seen nothing like that.
That's crazy, because with the hummingbirds, you know, their wings are moving so fast that they become transparent. So was that the same situation with this bird?
It was similar. Yeah, it was similar to that. Like it was kind of far away, but the impression that it gave me was of a hummingbird, the way that it kind of flitted back and forth. It's kind of like upright position. Yeah, it was just like a big hummingbird.
And then I also heard y'all got to eat some fresh caribou.
We did. That was crazy. Just kind of like how it all came about. We were at the campsite and we had the state trooper just roll up, and just being a group of Black and brown folks, that's just unnerving to have the police roll up on you. So he comes up and lo and behold, he's saying we fit the description. Not necessarily us personally, but our vehicle fit the description of a hunter that he was looking to meet up with, because I guess there was a hunter who had accidentally shot a female caribou and he was turning himself in about it. And he was in a gray pickup truck. So when this trooper had spotted our gray pickup truck, he just came over there to try to investigate and find this hunter. And then uh, we well, Chad had talked with him and I guess let him know what we were up to out there. So when he did go and find the hunter that he was trying to meet up with, and he retrieved that kill from him, he offered it to us. He brought it to us, and that was an experience because it was just like a freshly killed field dressed, you know, like it was just like gutted basically. Besides that, it was just like a whole ass deer. So
wow,
that was an experience of just chopping that up, butchering it down, skinning it and all that, and trying to preserve it, you know. It's a whole thing. So it's hundreds of pounds of meat, and we're trying to figure out what to do with it. We don't have refrigeration out there. We're not prepared for all this, so we're trying to figure it out. There's not really adequate firewood readily available, because I'm sure, as you remember, like once you cross a certain point, there ain't no trees, just, you know, larger bushes, and that's about it. So that was a big ordeal that one of the participants and I, we went on just driving, trying to find wood to burn so that we could actually cook this thing. And we ended up being gone for like an hour and a half or something, because drove so far, and then just like picking up stuff, trying to find an actual tree, but we were just too far away out of the actual tree zone that we just had to fill up the whole truck full of bushes, basically, like branches off of bushes from the side of the road.
That's really intense. Really intense. I mean, it really makes you consider what we take for granted, being able to go to the grocery store and grab something to eat and come in the house and turn on an appliance to cook. So yeah. You said hundreds of pounds of meat that had been dressed, meaning it had been gutted, but you guys had to actually butcher it, skin it. You didn't have refrigeration, but it's summertime. So you're in the Arctic. So in the winter, it would have been cold enough to keep it outside, right? But it's summer, so it's not that cold. It probably gets a little colder as it gets darker towards that part of the evening. Now, you could also, you run the risk of attracting predators with the smell of the meat too. So how much of the meat were you able to eat, and how much were you able to preserve? I mean, tell us about that process.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, like a small percentage, honestly, out of the whole of what it was. I think we were able to barter actually some of it to a neighboring camp and got some firewood, and I think like some s'mores or like some chocolate and marshmallows or something from them, or like maybe one of the haunches or something like that. So that was, you know, that was a cool little experience, being able to barter with some neighbors. But it was difficult. I mean, just having the right tools is a big deal. Having a nice sharp knife, the right shape of knife to be able to skin the animal, to probably like separate the skin from the meat on that very thin kind of connective tissue is an art form, you know what I mean? And it can go really bad if you don't know what you're doing. So that took some doing. And, you know, I had some experience with hunting, you know, as a kid going out living in Idaho is just kind of thing that people do. But I was on my way to go and help pick up the firewood, so I missed most of that stuff. I wasn't really a part of it, but just, you know, kind of wanting to be a part of it, you know, I took the knife and did a couple of slices just to say that I helped, you know what I mean? And then we took off and went to go find the firewood. But of it all, like, I think we definitely ate some ribs. We kind of cut that up and racked them up against the fire. I mean, that was even a whole thing too, trying to figure out how to orient them against the fire and make a structure that would allow us to cook the meat and keep it out of the fire. Trying to find some flat rocks to kind of use as kind of like a griddle plate type of a thing. So many different ideas all in the same place, just trying to make it work. Some, you know, cooking on spits, like on sticks, just trying to like roll it around like a weenie, you know what I mean? Like in the, like a hot dog in the, on the campfire as a kid type of thing. Like everybody was trying something, and none of it was quite enough. I mean, I won't say that. Like, we definitely got some good meat out of that. It was really tasty. It was really good. We had a vegetarian in the group that just had to try some of the meat, you know what I mean? And she was happy for it too. The next day after that caribou was brought to us, we were planning to go further up into the Dead Horse area. And in that place, they have, you know, like the man camp and the hotels and stuff like that where you can get food. And we did have a veritable smorgasbord compared to what we had been eating. Well, I mean, you know, actually literal smorgasbord. You know, there's like a variety of food. It's all really high quality. They feed the guys up there really good. And it's kind of all you can eat thing. So it was actually a pleasant surprise. And while we were there, I asked the cooks if we could get some sauce, you know, for our caribou back in the camp. And the guy whipped us up like some barbecue sauce and gave it to us in a big cup. So now here we go with this like big cup of just barbecue sauce. And we had asked him for like some bags of ice too. So we had like ice and this caribou barbecue sauce. And now we're headed back south, back to our camp. And at this point in time, it is starting to get a little bit dark at night. It is still, the sun pretty much just goes around in a circle in the sky, which is a little eerie. And you lose track of time. We'll be at the camp. Even that, actually, at that time when we were trying to find the firewood and trying to deal with this meat and everything, time is just going by. And the next thing you know, you look up and it's kind of dusk. It looks kind of twilight, but that means it's like 11:30 at night. And before we had even really started eating or anything like that, it was like maybe 1 a.m. So then fast forward to the next day, we're coming back, and not only was it kind of that twilight era time when the sun is just starting to kind of peak below the horizon, and it makes a big difference because, you know, it is peaking below the horizon a little bit, so it's a lot darker than it had been. And then add on to that, this thick fog that kind of rolls in on that north slope of the Brooks Range. It gets really kind of foggy just because of the atmospheric conditions with the Arctic Ocean right there and this big mountain range. We ran into that coming back, so it was really pretty dark as we were trying to find our way back to our place. And that's something that was kind of eerie because, like I said, it hadn't felt that dark in weeks, you know, since we've been up there. And then all of a sudden, it's all misty and foggy and dark and only slightly familiar. But yeah, when we got back to the camp, immediately made a fire and started back onto that caribou meat, but this time with a little bit of barbecue sauce. And it definitely kicked it up a notch. You know, I was happy for it.
That's such a great story. I you know, having been familiar with the area and the environment, I'm seeing it all. And even though I wasn't there for your trip, I saw pictures of that caribou roasting over the fire. And so I'm over here imagining how it smelled and seeing a little piece of ash drift off the fire and stick it to the meat and all that.
Mm-hmm. All that.
Were you able to use most of the animal that was in your possession, or did you have to just leave some for the predators and scavengers up there?
Yeah, we had to leave some behind because we just didn't have the means to keep it fresh. The ice, you know, melted. We didn't have like the right cooler size to it. We had other food that we are, you know, yeah, we just weren't prepared for all that bounty, right. Unfortunately. So yeah, some of it got left to the circle of life out there.
There's a lot of layers to be unpacked in terms of what you're sharing here. One being in thinking about the work that Operation Rome is doing in association with the Gwich'in. Did you all meet and were you in community with indigenous people while you were up there learning about the history of the land and the kind of interdependent relationship that people have with the environment and the wildlife?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, we met with Bernadette.
Right.
Who was the steering committee chair for the Gwich'in people. And she did a lot of explaining about their, you know, traditional way of life and how it's threatened and how that exists here now in modern times with all of the realities that they face as they grow up kind of in this society, but apart from it and trying to hold on to their values and whatnot. We did also meet with, what was his name, Alexander. Met him up at the school where he teaches, and he relayed, you know, a similar experience about growing up and wanting to be an advocate and kind of like a steward for their culture. I think he's working in preserving the language, you know, at the school. And I feel like I would have liked to spend more time actually like in community with the folks just to gain a little bit more insight, to gain a little bit more respect for their condition and how, yeah, life here in this current society that is, you know, seems to just continually oppress them in their specific way. You know, as a black man, this society is oppressive in a particular way. And as Native peoples, society is oppressive in another particular way. And I think the more that we can share in those experiences and learn from each other, the more power that we will have in understanding how we can meet on our common grounds and fight against that oppressive nature that, you know, is just pervasive here in this Western society, with whether it be through the capitalism, through, you know, the white settler colonialism, which kind of go hand in hand, and yeah, the whole white supremacist culture that we're exposed to.
Yeah, that's
I feel like.
No, thank you for putting that analysis in there, because it's integral. You know, we could talk about the beauty of the land, and we can even talk about people's ethnicity, but we have to name the systems that have been historically impacting our lives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's
deep out there, you know what I mean? Similar to, like, you know, black folks grow up in the hoods or a ghetto or whatever. But Native folks are on the res, you know, in a lot of places. They're in a reservation. In Alaska, maybe it's a little different, but our closest proximity would be to like go to Warm Springs or something like that, you know, and check out the reservation and just kind of see the conditions and see what they're left with. Like literally they've been left with the leftovers of what the white people wanted to take and use for their own benefit. And it's really a shame. It can be very eye-opening. But then also, like, more so what I was thinking of is, like, say, for example, being able to go out and just live a day in the life of someone in the community out on the North Slope or out there in the refuge, in the Arctic Village, or and just see what the day to day is and what they face. I mean, I was able to last year, maybe about 6 months after that Rome trip, go back to Alaska with Chad, helping him out with the film project that he was doing. And this was, you know, pretty much an opposite experience because it was there in the winter now. The end of the winter, but still definitely winter. And in that experience, during my time, I was able to go to a native village that exists out beyond the oil fields. Very remote, very inaccessible community out there. And yeah, just to kind of see like the reality of like where folks grow up at and what it means to like go to the store, how much it costs to get a pack of hamburgers, you know, the fact that everybody has a big old truck because that's just what you need. And the level of isolation that you feel out there, but also just seeing that the connections are very deep because, you know, we're just out there not really engaged with folks. And as people drive by, our traveling companion, Sikonik, who is a Nupiat, she was like recognizing them and, you know, kind of had some feelings about how this might unfold as people realize that she's here and then they start showing up or whatever might happen. Yeah, just the kind of different dynamics that exist within the community over there. And in a lot of ways also affected by the outer influence that's going on. In the way, like when we say, when Black folks might be in the space, say you roll up into your old neighborhood or something, and somebody's like, "Oh, come over here." I mean, then what you gonna say? Who all over there? Because you don't know if you want to see these folks or not. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So it was a little bit of that energy going on, and I thought that was interesting.
Wow. Man, you're lucky that you got to experience the more intimate level of interaction with folks. But I know, I also recall, as you said, you kind of wish you got to experience more of that. And then you get to unpack the similarities between, say, your lived experience being a Black man in the United States and some of the Native folks up there. And that, you know, even though we have different environments, there are some things that we can recognize about each other that are familiar. You're
definitely
about
to common struggle.
Mm-hmm. You're about to go to DC. What are you? You guys are going out there to lobby Congress to protect this land, and to protect the land, you're also going to be protecting people's relationship, indigenous people's relationship to the land. What are you hoping to get out of that experience yourself?
Yeah, I feel like I'm really interested in just kind of gaining some insight in how the process works when it comes to lobbying. You know, you hear about people lobbying congressmen all the time, usually like in a negative connotation because we're talking about big corporations lobbying for their interests against, you know, against the interests of the people for the most part, whether it be oil and gas, whether it be tobacco, those kind of things. So to have the opportunity to go and, you know, put our feet to the floor out there and get into the face of like the lawmakers, the decision makers, and get some training and some experience on how to voice those concerns, how to present those issues and make your case, I guess, I think is something that I'm really looking forward to, as well as getting a better look at the organization that has been involved in that work, the Alaska Wilderness League, seeing, you know, their offices, seeing the people that work there, getting a look at their day to day and how they go about their work. I think that that's something that also interests me a lot. And being able to do all that in a group of Black and Brown folks, I think is really amazing as well. I know that initially signing up for that Operation Rome came with, you know, like a commitment to be willing to step up and do exactly this. So it's something that I always kind of like had on my radar as a possibility, and something that I was looking, that I would look forward to. So now to see it actually come to fruition is really amazing. I think I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm hoping to be able to make something out of it.
Let me know how I can support that work here. I can't make the trip, but I'm happy to be able to interview you about it, get this on the air and out to our audience. Solomon, thank you for spending some time with us here on Culture in Motion. And I look forward to connecting with you when you get back from DC. But I'm wishing you guys to have a safe and productive trip.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I appreciate the time, and I'll let you know how it goes.
Okay, brother. Have a good day.
Yeah, bless you.
Bye-bye. I am Mike Crenshaw, your host of Culture in Motion, where we talk about the intersection between art, culture, music, activism, and politics.
I am Dr. Demento. I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
Here at KBOO, we'll be kicking off our winter drive on February 20th, which happens to be National Love Your Pet Day. Isn't this a heartwarming and fun holiday? We want to ask you to please record